The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and it is Saturday, January 12th, 2013. And I welcome you to what is going to be an interesting program, which I have entitled Sandy Hook Part 2. I don't have a guest, although I did ask last week's guests to come on again, but neither of them could. Which turns out for the best, as it usually does for me, as I have a lot to say on the subject, and I can now direct it just to where I want it to go. And I say that I don't have a guest, but in a sense I do have several of them that I'll be using direct statements from. And then there are you listeners who may call into the show at 1-830-443-4911. But somebody called in while the music was on, before the show actually started, and I didn't answer it. They're gone now. I think it was 856 area code. I would invite you to call again, but not right at the moment. Somebody's pretty anxious to say something. But let's get started, and I was going to ask for people to, to wait until the second half of the show, which I would prefer to call in, because it does kind of interfere with my hearing the break music and so on when people call and hang up. So that's why it's a good idea to wait until the second half of the show. If you can't call then and can only call now, well, I'm sorry. I apologize for that. And also, if you have the White Network on your Skype contacts, you can make a Skype call. I think that will – I can take that – I know I can take that. And I will try to do my best to handle these calls if I get some efficiently. I'm not always the best at that, but that's why it is kind of a good idea to wait until the second half of the show. So, and also I can't take calls before I get on, like this person was calling right as soon as the show the music started, and I can't take calls during the break either. So you have to wait until the second part of the show starts. And I'm already talking before you make your call. All right, thank you very much for that. And I hope I do get some calls. I will do my best to get through as much as I can in the first hour. Now, I'm going to start by saying, what was the event? What exactly was the event, I guess I should say, that took place at Sandy Hook, Connecticut, last December 14th? Was it a false flag, a hoax, or perhaps a security drill gone wrong? I think false flag does not describe it, as that usually denotes creating a terror incident that you can blame on your enemy, more of an international event. Sandy Hook was a domestic event, I think a hoax would be something that is totally fraudulent, that seems to be real but didn't happen. So although I call the Holocaust a hoax, even though there was some things happening, but not the way they say. So, it you know, maybe either one of those words can fit, depending on how people define the word. I'm not convinced that nothing happened at Sandy Hook and that it's just a total media creation. I just can't accept such a thing at this point. It seems really impossible. There's too much involved in it. But I know that there are many things that I absolutely believe and feel like I know didn't happen, and that people can't believe that they could have been created and fool us all. So I may end up reaching that point where I understand that it's a total fake media event. But at this point, I don't think that. I think that a part of it really happened, but maybe not all of it, and I can't explain just how they carry off such things and which part is real and which is not at this point, although I have lots of ideas about different parts of it. But my premise for this program is that we don't have to explain it to know that it's not legitimate and that those who make an effort to pull us into lots of debate about the number and type of guns used, who said what, when, and other details, which I'll go into, may be doing so in order to bog down the public becoming aware of the big picture, which I will call our perception of reality. Okay, I hope you followed all that, but I'll be kind of repeating these ideas as I go through the show. And so I'll say what we need to do much more than to discover or prove whether Adam Lanza, say, was the killer or not, or other details or other parts of it are right or wrong. What we need to do more than this is to adjust or correct or shift into a higher, more discerning level the way we understand the nature of the world around us. In other words, we are all brainwashed. We are all indoctrinated, whether we can admit that or not. Some more than others, of course. I, of course, think I'm free of that, but there's areas where I still am, it has to be, because it's not easy to, as you're living in this world, it's not easy to really see it from a higher perspective where you would actually be able to see what was what while you're involved in it. So, nobody is immune to this, but it's just that, and it may be the degree to which some of us are more awake is not that big from those we think are totally asleep, but it might not be that big in the big picture, but it seems awfully big to us. Now, the fact that we are all brainwashed and indoctrinated to some degree from going way back in history, this is the reason the people who do these things get away with them. I believe it would be more profitable to take some of the attention we put on the bad guys and how we want to identify them and catch them and punish them, to put some of that attention, more of that attention on ourselves and how awake we are, how alert we are. This is what we need to, this is what we really need. We need to not only be trying to wake other people up, but even wake ourselves up even further than we are and be more alert than we are. So it's really up to us to see through the smoke and mirrors. There's no other way. It'd be nice if I'm not absolving the people who are doing this at all, but we'll never stop them from doing it because they'll always exist unless we no longer fall for what they're doing. And this is really the big job that we have. And if you have a public, therefore, that is immune to propaganda, that is harmful to themselves. Now, this is what's most important, because there could be some propaganda that is not harmful to us. And when I say us, I cannot speak of the whole world. You know, I don't, and I'll say something more about that in a minute. But every group has their own idea, and it's right, and they're right about what's harmful for them. And if we were immune to what is harmful to us, well, there's nothing that these bad guys could do to us except, you know, violent force and so on. But that doesn't really work all that well, so that's not really used that much. Because if we're immune to what is harmful to ourselves, what they're doing, you know, simply wouldn't work on us. So there are some of us who have reached, I kind of spoke about that already, that some of us have reached this level, but not for everything, but for many things. There are some who think they've reached this level, but haven't because of political blind spots. Now, note I said harmful to themselves. That's why homogeneous societies are superior to multicultural and multiracial societies in maintaining stability and in defending themselves. I mean, this to me is a very clear truth. Yet those liberals and anti-racists deny it for political reasons. The white network is based on this truth, and that's why we stand for white racial nationalism, because we feel that that is the only way that if we as a group identify with this, that we can understand what's harmful to us and what is not, and that we can defend ourselves. You can't defend yourself if you're all having different ideas about what's harmful to you. And that's the state that we're in now, and I'll point that out a little bit more as I go along here. So I'm going to repeat that we shouldn't get too caught up in debating the details, although I get very interested in details. I'm a detail person. I've always been. I focus on details just automatically, and I'm real good with details. But I hope that I can see the big picture too. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't, you know, deal with details at all. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that, I think I'll make that clear as I go along. So the purpose is, the purpose that they have is to keep us in a false perception of reality where terrible, violent things can strike out of the blue on a beautiful sunny day with blue skies. This is one of the main messages of Sandy Hook, I think, as it was with 9/11. Did you ever wonder why these events always take place on what everyone considers to be a beautiful, perfectly normal day? I think it's, of course, there are strategic reasons for that. Makes it easier for them to do what they're doing, but it's also can be to affect our perception of safety and of normality, to infect us with the idea that no matter how it might appear, there is no security except from black-clad policemen and the government media authorities that take charge and explain what happened and console us. And this last is very important, that they are right away consoling us and, you know, being the big parent. Life is not safe. That's the message, period. Life is not safe. And that's my overall introduction to this program, that I want you to know that this is what I am trying to get across in this program. And I came to these conclusions, or you might say thoughts, because they're not necessarily conclusions, sort of, but seemingly on my own during this past week. And I say seemingly because while I did come to them, I believe that we are in a connected consciousness. And the more alike we are, going back to the homogeneous racial groups and so on, the more homogeneous we are, the more we are connected in consciousness because we think more alike. And so ideas that, say, I have are out there, and people who are sympathetic, I'll say, sympathetic to me or have similar thinking people, having similar kind of thoughts and wanting to know the things the way I do, are very likely to pick up my thoughts as I am likely to pick up theirs. And so we don't know, you know, we're giving and receiving all the time in, not just through emails and internet that we're so fond of, but simply through consciousness. I'll just add here that those who think entirely differently, let's say I'll say a black nationalist who hates white people and might be thinking terrible, evil thoughts about what he'd like to happen to whites. I'm just, you know, using this as an example. I would not be picking up on those thoughts. You know, we don't have to worry in consciousness that we're going to be attacked by, you know, people who are trying to hurt us or so on. It's the law of attraction at work, and we just don't attract that. And vice versa. And so what we do attract is that which is like ourselves. Like attracts like. That's the law of in the universe. So this is helpful to us. So because I'm going to give you a message from Martin, who was on the show last week. You know, I had determined that this was how I wanted to present this. These were the ideas that I thought were most important. I was doing a little emailing with Martin, and he said he couldn't be on the show. He was doing, and he had some other events or things going on that he had to do then at this time. And also Don didn't really want to be on again. He said he didn't have that much to offer a second time around, and suggested I get professor from Florida Atlantic University. I'm going to talk about him in a minute, but I hate to have to look for his name now. How can I forget? I forget as soon as I get on the program. I forget all these things. Now, she says he's got his name right here. Well, they don't even give his name. All right. Well, you know, James Tracy. All right. He suggested I get it. Well, I did write to James Tracy just two nights ago, and I wrote very nicely to him, asked him to be on. But considering what's been going on for him, I am not at all surprised. I didn't think he would come on. He didn't answer. He wouldn't want to come on a show of this type on the White Network because he's already in so much trouble. So, and that's all right, but I'm going to use some information from him. But so that's why I'm here on my own, and which, as I said, is just fine. I told Martin, said he could send me a few ideas if I wanted them. I said, sure, send them to me and I'll read them. So he did. It's not very long, so I'm going to just read it as he wrote it. He said, I hope you find these comments helpful. Now, I'm not buying into everything that Martin said last week, but I do like Martin. I liked him. I got a good impression of him the first email I got from him, and it hasn't changed since. Everything I've talking on the program last week and everything that I've the communication since then, and I think he's very courteous. He's very intelligent. He's right to the point. He's very helpful. So I have a good feeling about Martin. I don't think he's one of these people who's trying to derail things. I think he sincerely thinks he's onto something there with a lot of other people who are in that place, that way of thinking. I never was, and I'm just now feeling a little bit more open to it because I like the people that I'm talking to, but I don't think they're hoaxers either. So Martin writes, I think the big problem here is that people believe just what they want to believe. Unfortunately, some people are just incapable of comprehending the things we discussed in the first Sandy Hook show. They will point blank refuse to look into the possibility of a hoax. My own close relatives are like this. Usually, I tell these people I don't watch television, that you can't trust anything in the news. I keep it vague, but they know my position. We agree to disagree. Thankfully, with shows like yours, Carolyn, there is a lot of good information out there. I think we need to work from this nucleus of switched-on people. It's a forum where we can be outspoken to good effect. Gradually, awareness of the issues will expand. I'll just interject here that he says shows like mine, and doesn't mean only mine, which should be noticed, and also that this is what he says is just the way we think of the White Network, that we wanted to have a place for to speak to the people who already were in the know, or at least were interested in this, in the way we present things, and not trying to go out and bring in people who aren't in the know yet, which is the purpose that some people have in this so-called movement. And that's all right, but that should be clear. Those who want to reach those who aren't already, who are still lost in space out there, or those of us who want to reach the people who can now be reached and help us to create stronger, a stronger nucleus of intelligent debate on discussion on the issues and so on, and increase the awareness and increase everybody's knowledge and so on. So he goes on, finally, the alphabet agencies can be expected to put all sorts of finely honed material out there. Can be expected to. That's what we have to remember. It shouldn't be a surprise when we say, oh, look, I think these people are trying to fool us. Well, we need to understand that's part of the perception we need to develop, that they're going to do it, and we just expect it. It's not a surprise. So back to Martin. To discredit the investigation into a possible hoax and the motive for that hoax. They operate in the alternative media as well, working to this end. Absolutely right. That's why it's important for us to put our views across in a calm, rational way. Remember, whatever happens, we still haven't seen evidence of real deaths. and we're trusting the word of the government every step of the way in the total absence of credible, independent, third-party sources or any checks and balances in the system allowing for full public scrutiny. That's the end of Martin's thoughts. I agree with that in general, but I don't know if we haven't seen evidence of real deaths. Well, we haven't. People are pointing to funerals as evidence of real deaths. A funeral is not evidence of that. And the only funerals we've actually seen any photographs or video of is Victoria Soto's funeral. And I'm going to talk about how, as I go on, how Victoria Soto and this Parker, now I can't think of his first name. Anyway, the Parker guy in the Parker family, they are the ones that we see mostly about. Everybody else seems to be, you know, some people you see nothing about them. Now, it could be the decision of the family, how open they want to be about it. And I can accept that. I would not dispute that. So, but we have, isn't he Randy Parker? I don't know. We have seen some video of the casket coming out of the church of the Victoria Soto funeral. And it's pretty hard, you know, to think that that's all made up and there was nobody. Because there's people there and so on. So, you know, I have to assume that there was a funeral at this point. And also, there was a big article about Parker. I got to find this guy's name. Oh, Lordy. I don't want to spend any time looking for it. Anyway, there was a memorial service in Ogden, Utah for Emily Parker. And and her father was there. And there are all these pictures. And the Daily Mail played it up real big. Oh, funeral for Emily Parker draws so many people and so on. And they had all these photographs. And there was the father. Well, the first thing, it was not a funeral. It was a memorial service. It was not her funeral, which I don't know when that took place. I haven't seen anything about that. That doesn't mean there wasn't anything. But I haven't seen any photographs or anything about Emily Parker's funeral. But this memorial service in Ogden, Utah, where they grew up, the girls grew up, where they used to live, you had all these pictures of the father, Parker, and he, not a tear on his face the whole time. Not a tear in two photographs he has his face covered. You know, he's got his face in his hands in one, like he's, you know, overwhelmed with grief. But you don't see his face, so you don't know. And another one, he's kind of got his face buried in somebody's shoulder who's, you know, saying something to him. So you don't see that. But, you know, you get the impression that he's just, you know, weeping or something. But you never see that. And the ones with his face, there's no tears in his eyes or coming down his eyes, although in one he's got an expression where he's sitting on the floor of the church with his tennis shoes on and his casual clothing, where some of the people in the church are wearing suits and, you know, they've all come to pay their respects and so on. They're crying. And here's this guy. He's trying to look like he's sort of distraught. He's got an expression on his face, but no tears. So, and the mother wasn't there because they said she was too fragile. The other two daughters weren't there. They would have taken pictures of them if they were. So it was just father who went to that. And they're trying to play that up as a funeral. So really, I've read about some funerals, but I haven't seen any photographs of them. Now, just to move on from that. There has also been some comments at the White Network about last week's show, and I got some information from it. I'll just read part of this one. It was from Martin to Britt in Norway, and he said, I wanted to respond to your post above, in which they have a little disagreement going on there. And he said, please check out the interviews with the former journalist from RIA Novosti and KGB informant Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmenov, who contended that the majority of our state intelligence operations are, in fact, aimed at ideological subversion, which means use of the mass media to alter people's belief systems and change cultural mores. Now, get that? He's saying that, and he says that very correctly, because I looked this guy up, that the majority of the state intelligence operations that the KGB carried out, and he was one of their good agents, I guess, top agents or something. Anyway, he was not a nobody. Are aimed at ideological subversion. That's what they're doing. And Martin says if this is correct, then it would be reasonable to surmise that most, but not all, of Mossad's operations are based on media trickery, with the remainder being military or tactical in nature. That is, if the Mossad operated the way the KGB did, that this is the way they would be operating. And he says the Kiryat Ono Photography College, part of Ono Academic College in a northern district of Tel Aviv, is one likely base for the AFP press agency's fraudulent photographic work. I guess AFP news agency is basically Jewish now, if it wasn't always. Anyway, that's Martin's opinion. Now, I looked up Bezmenov, and he's someone who came to the United States, and he was allowed to become to find a political asylum in Canada, and that's where he was stationed. And I don't know when this was, probably in the 80s or something. He was in India working for the KGB, and he got upset about some things they were doing, and he liked the Indian people, so he found a way to, get away. He disguised himself as a hippie and joined a tour group and ended up getting to Athens. And from there, he went to the authorities and, talked to him. And eventually, they let him go further to the west, and he's, was accepted in Canada. So then he started telling about all the things, and he wrote this book called Love Letter to America, in which he states, this is a biography, not an autobiography, a biography somebody wrote for him. He, like a true life Winston Smith from George Orwell's 1984, Thomas Schumann, well, he wrote under the pen name of Thomas Schumann, worked for the communist equivalent of Orwell's Ministry of Truth, RIA Novosti. Novosti, which means news in Russian, exists to produce slanted and false stories to plant in the foreign media. The term for this KGB effort is disinformation. Then I went to the YouTube videos and I watched one of the shorter ones, which turned out to be the right one to watch. And I have some quotes from him from that video, which are pertinent to what we're dealing with now, and what we've been dealing with, and what we're still dealing with, and how we should be looking at this, I think. So, talking about intelligence, the intelligence operations, he said it's nothing to do with espionage, or he should mean little to do with espionage, which I know is more romantic, James Bond and all. That is only 15% of the budget. The other 85% is a slow process in which we call, ideological subversion, or quote, active measures, unquote, this is in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare, which we call PSYOPs. We hear, as with my little addition. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. Now, in repeating, despite the abundance of information, by changing the perception, a person's perception of reality, they are unable to defend themselves. They can't come to the right conclusions to defend themselves, their families, their community, or their country. And he says there are four stages. Number one is demoralization. I'm just going to read this from what I wrote down from what he said, takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. This is the number of years it takes to educate one generation of students. After that, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. Even if I shower him with authentic information, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him to a concentration camp in the Soviet Union, he will refuse to believe it until military force crashes his world. Well, I've kind of put this in my own words because he said this in a longer way. You have to be kicked in the rear end and so on, he says. But he meant until the military, till the final objective happens and this you are crushed with military force, then you'll believe it. But he says until then, a demoralized person will not. A person who has actually really been indoctrinated strongly. And this was the position of the Soviet Union in the way they handled their intelligence operations in other countries. And then the second stage is something he called destigmatization, which I don't know if he got the word wrong or I just couldn't understand it, but I think it means destabilization. I think that's what he meant to say. And this takes 2 to 5 years. What matters, this is just theoretically, of course, what matters is essentials, the economy, foreign relations, defense system, Marxist-Leninist ideas in society. Well, he said, what he said was, when I got here, when I got into the West, I was just shocked and amazed at the extent of Marxist-Leninist ideas that were in the American-Canadian society already. And then I've come up with some examples of what these would be. This is for me, pro-Semitism, homosexuality, anti-pro-homosexuality, anti-religion, anti-family, government as the answer to everything, mass public surveillance, airport searches, dominance of mass entertainment in society, which we have really bad, anti-nationalism, pro-mixed culture, mixed marriage, anti-racism. These to me are the Marxist-Leninist ideas that are destabilizing our Western worlds, also in Europe. The third stage is the crisis stage, and says it may take only 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. I guess once you have destabilization gone far enough, then you can create a crisis. That would be, I would think, government failure, breakdown, crash of goods and services. Just what we think of when we think of the, you know, everything coming apart. And then after that, he says, the fourth step or stage is normalization, which may last indefinitely. It's a cynical expression, he says, that is called normalization. Brezhnev used it first. He said, what it means is putting a big brother government in Washington, D.C. with benevolent dictators like we have now and have had many of them, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfilled or not. Your leftists, all these university professors, they are instrumental in this process of subversion, only to destabilize the nation, though they're used to destabilize the nation. And when the job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. He says they may get disillusioned when they see how things turn out. Therefore, they're not reliable, and they think they will come to power, but they will be lined up and shot. So now I realize that this man was a conservative. He got very turned off to communism, and he went the opposite way, and he came to this country, and he got involved with certain groups. But basically, I think what he's saying is right in what we need to be aware of in what is going on in the intelligence. You know what intelligence operatives are doing, what they're mostly doing. And that is, the objective is to change our perception of reality into the way they want it to be. And this is why our perception is what we should guard and look at and check on and work at most of all. Now, to go on with the Sandy Hook affair, the latest news that I came upon, I think it was just last night, was that now we're going into James Tracy, the college professor, but a top official, they call her a top official in the grief-stricken Connecticut town of Sandy Hook has come out with a statement saying a Florida college professor who blogged that the Sandy Hook school massacre may have been staged or didn't happen at all is an embarrassment who should be fired from the public university where he teaches. And she goes on in this email, I guess, to Fox News, which has gone all over, you know, as a basic news story. Her name is Patricia Lodra, L-L-O-D-R-A. She's the first select man in Newtown. So I guess, and that's the highest office there is. So that's what they use for, I guess, a mayor or whatever, the first select man. And she's talking about James Tracy, an associate professor of media history at Florida Atlantic University. And he has a website called memoryholeblog.com. But he's been writing articles about Sandy Hook on, see how I can't remember the names of things on that website, in that Canadian website where I've been reading them. And I also listened to, I lost my place. And I also listened to his radio interview on Guns and Butter with that woman. I can't think of her name either. But it's pretty good. In all of that he's written and all that I listened to, I thought that he was very credible sounding. I don't think he's a plant put out there to move, you know. Sometimes we find out later that these people who sound so good are plants who are part of the, you know, the controlled opposition. But at this point, I don't think that. He seems like someone who's willing to. He's tenured, and he teaches about conspiracy. He has one of his classes about conspiracy theory, and he's been teaching this stuff for a long time. And he has a record on all these things, starting with the JFK assassination. So anyway, he seems to be doing a good job, and so they're violently attacking him right away. And she says, shame on you too, FAU, Florida Atlantic University, to even have someone like this on your payroll. See, right away, I checked her out. She's a blonde woman. It doesn't sound like her name is Jewish or anything. But she's acting like in this vicious way that they want people to be fired from their jobs if they don't go along with what they say is happening. And this woman is representing Sandy Hook. And, you know, they've got we have to remember that they have a big fundraiser on the internet for Sandy Hook. And they're probably taking in lots of donations and so on. And this makes them important. It's just amazing how people want to put themselves on the map, with things that they don't even care. They don't care about the truth. It's just how it advances their interests. So she's saying, Professor Tracy is an embarrassment to me as an educator and should be to you as well, speaking to the university he works at. I can assure you, sadly, that the events here in Newtown unfolded exactly as are being reported. Well, how can she do that? But anyway, she says, with the horrible outcome of, you know, the violent death of 26 innocent people, including 20 children. This is kind of like, they always repeat that, kind of like when the Holocaust is mentioned. They always have to, that's an opportunity to repeat how the Nazis murdered 6 million Jews. And every time they mention the Sandy Hook affair, they always repeat the death toll. So she goes on, you know, it is outrageous and an insult to all caring people to think that this man would choose this event as a stage for his outlandish conspiracy theories. And she said, you notice that she said, shame on you. And this is the phrase we're going to hear. We're already hearing it, that shame, shame, shame on you for questioning what happened here. And I'm going to talk about an article at Salon.com, which used the phrase, have they no shame, meaning the people who are questioning this. Have they no shame? This is very interesting, and I'm going to use this to talk about some of the events here that happened. Salon.com is a very left-wing, very establishment-connected website. I think it's horrible. You know, I never read it. But they had this article, so that was recommended somewhere. So I did, and it says, meet the Sandy Hook truthers. See, they're already discrediting. This was from January 9th. They're discrediting anybody who would question this. And they said, theorists think they found absolute proof that Newtown was a hoax. Have they no shame? They start out saying that the supposed ties between the gunman's family, that is the father of Adam Lanza, was connected to the LIBOR banking scandal. And that was a big story, which I guess has been debunked. And so they start out with that to show that that these people are, you know, don't know what they're talking about. And then after some other ridiculing of the truthers, they say they talk about Emily Parker, and they say the girl in question is Emily Parker, a six-year-old who was shot multiple times and killed at Sandy Hook. But for conspiracy theorists, the tears her family shed at her funeral, the moving eulogy from Utah's governor, and the entire shooting spree are fake. Welcome to the world where Sandy Hook didn't really happen. Well, I already talked about the tears her family shed, at her funeral. Well, I already, you know, I couldn't wait, so I already mentioned that there was no funeral. We haven't seen a funeral. And that there were no tears by her family at that memorial service. Maybe if there's somebody, I hope in the second hour someone will call me if they know that there was media coverage of this Emily Parker's funeral. I looked pretty carefully around, and I think I would see it if it had been. That there was an interview with what's his name? Do they give his name here? Isn't it Randy? Randy Parker. There was an interview with him and his wife in which she was doing a lot of crying. But again, these people, they distort their face and their voice is shaking and all that, but you seldom see any real tears. After they get done and get their composure, their face is dry. It's just they're not using Kleenexes. They're not sniffling. They're not blowing their nose. Nothing like this is happening. And she was, you know, very, very, she did a good job. If this is acting, you know, these two are real actors. And I don't think I have it further on, so I just will say that we talked about it quite a bit last week, that video that was shot of Mr. Parker coming on to give his talk the day after the murders and had the big smile on his face and so on. And, I think I'm going to cover that in the second half. With the radio with the Kevin Barrett radio show. But there's no mistaking, no matter how people tried to explain away that, well, you know, when you're grieving, you never know how you're going to act, and people sometimes smile and laugh and, you know, as just a relief, as a release and so on. I don't find that at all convincing. So, they go on and on about how all these videos extolling the Emily Parker hoax theory, that if you Google her name, the very first result is a post mocking her father for crying at a press conference after the shooting. And I just say, what? Now, this is his press conference I was just telling you about, why he would even go on it. But he obviously got into his acting role, and he wasn't crying. He was just catching his breath. He was making faces. He was doing this, but I didn't. There were no tears. There was no crying at that press conference. And it says, then it mentions the popular video, which I'm sure some of you have watched, by the producer of the 9/11 Truther film, I think you know which one. It's had 134,000 views when this was written. And he's the one who put together the two pictures of the Parker girls and said that they were the same girl. Now, this is something that I think is a big mistake. I do not believe. I did it one time. I mean, when I first looked at it, I thought, oh, gosh, that is the girl. But as you study all these pictures, and I've looked at a lot of pictures of the Parker family, and the thing about it is that even though that girl with – in the pictures with President Obama looks exactly like Emily in the picture where she's wearing that dress. The fact is, you don't know when these pictures were taken. And it's my judgment that this picture, the best known one of the three girls with the two parents and the little Emily is sitting off to the side of her father wearing that dress, well, the first one they ever showed. This is not when she was in first grade. This is not when she was 6 years old. I don't think so. I don't know. They don't tell you when, but she looks younger than she looks in those in her first grade pictures and other pictures that I've seen quite a few of the family, the three kids together. So I also decided that the one girl was not a stand-in for the other because there's too many pictures that came out later that they put on their Facebook page for fundraising, I guess, that show all three kids, and they can't all be, you know, fakes. So I believe they had these three children, and I believe that the thing is that Emily and her sister look almost exactly alike at the same age, so that Emily in this picture, this most famous picture, and then the second daughter in the picture with Obama after 2 or 3 days after the shooting, wearing Emily's dress, maybe on purpose to confuse people, to start up these rumors, looks, by then, her hair is longer. They've got her hair fixed just like Emily's is fixed here. She looks exactly like Emily did at that age. So that's what I think. I think these pictures are taken at different times. And if you see pictures of Emily from recent, you know, when she was in the first grade, she looks a lot older than she does in this picture where she's first wearing that black and red costume. And then they put that costume. Now, that is tasteless to put that same dress on the second daughter to go see Obama. But I don't think that has anything to do with it. Because often, you know, a little girl, I was a second daughter, and you want to wear your sister's clothes. I mean, I did. I saw all my sister's clothes as eventually coming to me. She got the new clothes. I got them secondhand, but it didn't bother me because I would say, oh, boy, I can't wait till I have that dress or that whatever. And maybe not all kids are like that, but and they could say, well, she wanted to remember Emily by wearing her dress and things like that. So there's, you know, that's not a good reason to dispute, to put down the family. But I think that they put her in that dress maybe on purpose for this very reason, to confuse and start more rumors that could be debunked. And I think this is one that's a mistake, and a lot of people are doing it. I mean, here's this, because they're so anxious to, you know, our egos really get in the way. And here's this producer of this, I don't know who he is personally, but he made a very popular 9/11 film. I don't know which one it was. They say, just as the movie Operation Terror shows the 9/11 attacks were a made-for-TV event, so too were the mass shootings, according to this video maker. Well, maybe what his movie was Operation Terror, the producer of Operation Terror. But he is just so certain, and he's done a very good video making people think that these two girls are the same one. But I don't agree with it because I've looked into it too much. And so there's an area where people are not being careful enough now. And so they can debunk the truthers as being wrong and crackpots and so on. And that's what they want to call people who are looking for the truth, crackpots. Now, I'm going to move on. This Salon.com article also says they also bring up the boy in the Dr. Oz interview, which I did also mention last week. But it's very interesting because I got the video of it finally. I found that and I watched it. And this, you know, Dr. Oz is such a character. You know, they put how many people just totally in love with Dr. Oz and just think everything he says is so right and he's so good and he's helping everybody. And here he's part of the establishment for sure. He's a part of the the media. Anyway, in this case, he went along with it. And he did this fakey kind of interview with some parents and children from the school. And as I said, this one boy talked about a drill. And there's a lot of questions. In fact, I think there's some good evidence that this thing has signs of being a drill or starting out as a drill. And then either they on purpose, well, it had to be on purpose, couldn't be a mistake, it was turned into the real thing. And it's so much there's so much good evidence that this could have been, has gone on in other of these what are called false flag incidents, 9/11 and 9/11 connected, 7/7 and some of those, that this drill thing, and they have these drills all the time. And then I watched something about this company that provides not only actors, but they put on these whole drill things and how realistic they are. And they had all these injured people there. These people learn how to act out the roles so that it's all very realistic. And they do these incredible involved drills, just like the real thing. Looks just like the real thing. They have tons of ambulances and emergency vehicles and police and this and that and medical people and so on, all there. When you look at it, you think you're looking at just the same thing. And Sandy Hook didn't even look that good. You know, I mean, that wasn't even happening at Sandy Hook. At Sandy Hook, there's a lot of questions about why everybody was at the firehouse and why nobody could get into the school except the police and that one coroner. So let's move on with that. The thing I wanted to say about Dr. Oz was that, he had a little boy there, that the one that I was talking about last week that he was chatting with. And this boy's mother, then I saw his mother sitting next to him and his grandmother sitting next to her. And this little boy couldn't have been the brightest boy. That's why he couldn't remember what he was supposed to say. But she probably volunteered him and she probably told him he would do a good job. She was like all done up, like she was trying to get a modeling job. I mean, she was all perfect looking. She was an attractive young woman and blonde, and she had this perfect makeup and her hair and everything. I mean, she didn't look like anybody who was just being a real person because she cared about, you know, because she was affected by what took place at Sandy Hook. So to me, I don't say that she was fake, but I say that she was using this opportunity thinking she might get some kind of attention or modeling job from it or something. Then her mother next to her was just real frowsy looking. At least she looked more convincing and sounded more convincing. And after Dr. Oz moved on to the next person down the line seated there, you could still see that little boy and his mother behind. And for, 10, 15 seconds or so. And he was standing up then. He was gesturing like goofy kids do, you know, who are not very well in control of themselves. And he was making funny faces at his mother and shaking his head and jerking his body around. His mother was just sitting there looking at him, talking to him, I guess. And like, you know, he was now maybe telling her, well, I don't know what happened there or what there, you know. But he was all animated, where when he was sitting there, he was just trying to do what he had been told to do. The whole thing. Then he talked to these other people, and the whole thing was just so programmed, so programmed. It's just, so I wanted to bring that up, that mother. And there are some other mothers who seem to be more interested in having the TV camera on them than anything else. Now the Salon.com article starts, goes into their criticism of somebody named Jay Johnson, who created a website called SandyHookHoax.com. And I've got that up here. And it is, I got to keep this other page for now. It is, I think it's a good website. I looked at it and I kept reading and looking everywhere. It has lots of good stuff on it. But the man is just a little bit strange, but probably isn't strange. I mean, that's just, He's just kind of has these spiritual beliefs, but he says his name is Jay Johnson and he created this website on 12/21/12, and he thinks that's has something to do with, mystical meanings and so on. But he made a statement that I totally agree with right in the beginning of his website. And he says, you know, in your heart that no one, he emphasizes, could walk into a school and start shooting defenseless little kids. They are trying to alter mass perception of the human condition so that people feel insecure and trust only the government to make things safe. And then he goes on that page. But, you know, I had that same thought some time ago. I don't know exactly when. Maybe I picked it up from him in consciousness. But people who are upset and want to go out and kill people, their target is not little kids, six-year-old kids in grade school. I mean, that just isn't in people's minds. I don't care how distraught they are or how angry they are. And then this story about Adam Lanza being in that school and wanting to get revenge because he was bullied, that's all untrue. And his mother was there, so he went to his mother's classroom to kill those kids. No, that's not true. So all their reasons for saying that he would want to go to that school and kill little kids fall apart. And I agree with this, Jay Johnson, that no people who want to go out and kill people would not go and kill defenseless little kids in a school. That just doesn't make sense. There's another reason why they were chosen. And we'll get into all of that. We're at our break. We'll have a 5-minute break, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here with me and stay with me. We'll have a very good second half. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and the subject is Sandy Hook Part 2. I want to again recommend this website by Jay Johnson called SandyHookHoax.com. SandyHookHoax, all one word, .com. And I won't say any more about him. I have some more written here, but I want to move along and get these other things in. So, and also I'll tell people that, if they want to call in, they can call in now, and just, the number is 1-830-443-4911, or make it a Skype call if you have the White Network as a contact. When you call, I can see it, but if I'm not looking there right at the moment, I can just let it keep ringing because I have to move to my Skype page to answer it and so on and so forth. So I'm not the quickest person in the world. Now, at this, we're still talking about this Salon.com article that was written on January 9th, posted on January 9th, about, trying to put down everything, any questions, and make out that these people are all crackpots and so on. Any questions about what happened at Sandy Hook other than the official version? Now, so naturally they go to James Tracy, and that's the and they say a tenured professor of communications at Florida Atlantic University sparked controversy after he wrote a blog post suggesting the parents were crisis actors. Now remember. It says suggesting, and that's what he was doing. He was suggesting things that might be. He didn't say for sure that he thought they were, but that he was suggesting these things. He's careful. He's a college professor, and he's been doing this, as I said, for a long time. So, and they quote what he said, and that's all they say about him. But then they follow it right up with Alex Jones. So they're connecting this James Tracy with Alex Jones, and they say that conspiracy site, the website owned by Alex Jones, who has millions of readers, is a virtual one-stop shop for Sandy Hook false flag miscellanea. And they say that something that Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America, had told Jones this summer that he thought there was a good chance the Aurora massacre was perpetrated by government agents. And then they say then there's just the downright bizarre subgenre of theories. One posting on the community forum of Jones' website connects Sandy Hook and Emily Parker to Satanism, postulating that the school was a recruiting center for the Church of Satan, the Sandy Hook School. And then they mentioned the Sandy Hook Lingerie Party massacre, which they think people are connecting with the Sandy Hook event, which I don't know anybody that is. I looked at that, too. That was crazy. I don't know why it's called Sandy Hook. It's one of those weird massacre movies. I guess there's a whole bunch of massacre movies. They listed them. I wasn't familiar with most of them, but even with the name of most of them. But there's a whole bunch of massacre movies that have been made. And they talked about that. So now this thing with Emily Parker and Satanism, it is strange that they use this. These kids are using this symbol in several of these photographs of the index finger and the little finger, holding that up and putting the two middle fingers down in the palm of the hand. So you have this supposed Satan symbol or Freemasonry, Illuminati symbol, whatever. And I used to think that this was the same as the Texas A&M symbol that President Bush was accused and other Texans are accused of using here and there. But it isn't. That symbol is just the upward thumb or maybe the little finger sticking out. But that's not the same thing. And this little girl, the youngest Parker child, in several photos, she's a thumb sucker, but she's not sucking her thumb. She's sucking these two middle fingers with the index finger and the little finger sticking out, making that sign. There's a lot of evidence for these kids doing this. And there's a picture of Victoria Soto where a man in the background, second from her, second, there's a woman next to her and then this man is next to her. And he's just sticking this symbol right out there in front of your eyes. When I saw that, I was thinking, oh, that's that Texas A&M symbol. He's probably doing that but no, I was wrong about that. It's not Texas A&M. So why is he making that? And if you wanted to ask about Photoshop, you might ask about that picture, who it is that would be Photoshopped in there. But I've been studying things on that Clues forum that Martin is on, although he hasn't done hardly anything on the Sandy Hook thread. But, it's amazing. These people, I think, are sometimes looking for things where there's nothing there. But as long as they're looking is good because they find a lot of stuff. And they point it out, and I wouldn't notice, but sometimes, a lot of times, you can find something wrong in that one person who's been added to the photo is not quite the right size. And I found that in this Holocaust, this Buchenwald liberation photo with that naked man that I was talking about there at Elie Wiesel at www.elieweaseltattoo.com. So I found that same thing. And that's a real important thing to look at when you're trying to talk about forged photographs. And there's plenty of forgery. There's plenty of it. And there's much more sophisticated stuff than that. But it's still the same thing. You have to study the photograph or the stills from the videos that they put out to see these signs of being Photoshopped. We call it Photoshop now. Where they've added, subtracted, changed things and so on. Okay, some points that I want to make following this article in Salon is why they're not allowing the injured woman to speak. There is a woman who in the school, the principal and the other teacher, whatever, who were shot by the gunman, they ran out into the hall, supposedly, by when they heard the noise. You know, the gunman shot his way through the glass door into the building, which was, you know, locked up, for schools are locked up now during school period time. And they were in a meeting in some room there, and they ran out to the hall right where he was. And he shot, and there was another woman there with him who was written up about extensively in an article I read. I've forgotten her name now, but they talked all about her, and she told me what a wonderful person she was. And he shot these three women, but the third woman was only hit in the hand, arm, and leg, and managed to hide behind a door, she said, or the person speaking, her friend said. And then he went on, and she managed to get into the back in the room and call 911 or call somebody or do something. But she survived, and she's supposedly in a hospital. And from that moment, we have not heard a word about her. And now they're saying, when they talk about this, they talk about these two women, the principal, whatever her name was, and something, and this other teacher. They were both killed, but they don't mention this woman. Now, they said at first that this woman, you know, had to get medical attention first, and yet how much time has gone by now? Well, it's close to a month. And we don't have any word from her. Obviously, they don't want her to talk. Obviously, she's not going to say what they want her to say. And they may be having trouble getting her to say what they want her to say. And so they're just trying to wash her out of the whole picture. But plenty of people remember her. So, that's going to keep coming up. Where is this woman in her testimony about what happened? Now, there's the other complaint is that there's no parents or survivors who are the police have decided and told us that no parents or survivors are able to speak until several months after the investigation is completed. Well, they've said it'll be several months before this investigation is completed. Several months, even though immediately afterwards they had the shooter and they had all the evidence and they had everything all done, but now it's going to take several months to complete this investigation. And in the meantime, they don't want anybody to speak about it. And they have assigned a police person to each family. There's like 20 families or something. Each family that's affected, they've assigned this police person to look over them and be what is that called, to be their spokesperson between them and the media or anything so that they won't be harassed. It's not up to them, you know. And this is what they do. Now, I have to say in here, this gives me the idea that this is why, you know, well, I'm saying that this is because they don't want anybody saying anything that will contradict what the official narrative is going to end up being, because they're probably not exactly sure how they're going to clean up all these loose ends and so on. So they're still forming the storyline. And this gave me the idea for the first time of an explanation why Elie Wiesel, I'm never very far away from thinking about Elie Wiesel, made a vow. He says, well, he was still in Buchenwald, or after he was liberated or something, to wait 10 years before writing his memories. And he said that the reason he's always given is that he wanted to be sure that he remembered things right, and that he would have the right words to use to tell what happened. He didn't have any confidence in himself enough. Now, how would waiting 10 years to write something give you better memory than writing it soon after it happened? You know, and yet he's continued to say that. He's continued to put it that way, that he wanted to make sure his memory was right. So I think, though, that the reason that he waited 10 years, obviously, is that he was involved with Irgun way back when he was a teenager, and he was already involved with all these people, and they were telling him what to do, and they told him to wait, because then when they got the story, the Holocaust story, all settled and determined, then he could write his thing and he wouldn't say great, because all these survivors were saying all these wild things in the beginning, you know, which have since been very much discredited. So there's a reason why they hold people off. They don't want people to tell their story because it won't fit their official version that they're going to come out with. So this is what they're doing with these parents, I think. And there's no interviews allowed with the parents. The state police have said they couldn't. I guess there's been a few. And so some certain news media are acceptable because they're part of the whole thing. But those who might be, you know, Maverick or something, they might get in there and get an interview, and they wouldn't want that to happen. So they only do everything with approved people. And then the Parker family and Emily, why do we see mostly the Parker family and Emily? And also, I already said, the other family most in the news is Victoria Soto's family. And they're quite willing to speak. And here's something. And the whole story about Victoria Soto's death and the and what happened to the children in her classroom has been totally confused and changed in different versions. And it's still, as far as I know, is not settled. You still read different things on different places, and it's not settled yet just what the story about this Victoria Soto is. So these two people are both the two most suspect people, and the ones we see that have been pushed forward as the biggest heroes, or the kind of the faces for this event. And in the Connecticut, the Courant, Hartford Courant, in December 23rd, this is going back to last year, about 10 days after the event there, the children write, the children escaped from the first grade classroom of teacher Victoria Soto, one of the six educators Lanza killed in Newtown. The arriving officers encountered a shocking scene in Soto's classroom. Lanza had shot her, as well as special education teacher Anne Marie Murphy, and six of Soto's 6- and 7-year-old students. Seven of Soto's students were found huddled and unharmed in a classroom closet, apparently hidden by Soto when she heard shooting. Notice it say apparently. The other students fled the classroom. Now, that makes, there were supposedly a class picture of her class. She had 16 students in her class. People have testified, how she loved her children. And she always said, oh, they're my 16 angels. You know, it was clear that there were 16 students in her class. But now you've got six of them killed and seven of them in the classroom. That adds up to 13. And then they said other students fled. So that is only, well, how did I come up with two or three? Six and seven is 13, yeah. Three others fled, and yet there's other stories that say that based on initial statements from surviving children and the fact that unfired bullets from Lance's rifle were found on the ground, detectives suspect that some students were able to run to safety during this time. And there's a story that I don't want to read all of this. There's a story that says the six children who escaped Lance's rampage ran to a home a short distance from the school. And there's this man who says that he found that he saw a group of children, and maybe he said six, on his lawn, and they're all scared and everything, and he asked them to come in his house. And they came in, and he was trying to entertain them, and they were telling him things, and this is supposedly, you're led to believe this is these children that ran away from Victoria Soto's classroom. But if there was six of them, and then you have six that were killed, and then seven that were in the closet, that's more than 16. So they'll come up with a way to cover that up, you know, to work that out. But then there are stories that that she was found protecting, you know, spreading herself over the children who were killed when she was found, and that she was protecting these kids. And yet the others, that they were in a closet, and the others who weren't ran out the door. Although he killed them, they tried to run away, and he killed them as they were running out, and killed her too. So then what about the ones who ran out and got out of the school? It's all, there's just one, none of these stories add up together. And I think that's because they're trying real hard to make her into a hero, into a heroine. It's constantly about Victoria Soto, the hero. And her family has played into that. They are so willing to get on camera and talk and be interviewed, including there's her mother and two sisters and a brother, and then there's this uncle. There's no father. I thought he was the father at first, but he's an uncle. And they're just constantly talking and emphasizing what a hero she was and what an absolutely perfect person she was, like Mother Teresa. And this is because they want to create heroes out of these people, particularly a school teacher and, you know, someone who was killed. So this is like remember, during the beginning of the Iraq War, when that Jessica Lynch, they created a hero out of Private Jessica Lynch, saying that she did all these heroic things, and then she was abducted by the Vietnamese and in a hospital where she wasn't being treated, and then the military group, you know, a special elite group went captured her there, and they put it all on TV, you know, in night vision and so on, like it was a big operation, and it finally turned out that she wasn't a hero at all, and that she had a broken leg, and that the Vietnamese put her in their hospital, and they were treating her, and then they didn't even have to go and break in, do this big operation, because they could just walk in. They would release her. They didn't want to keep her there. So you know, the whole thing was just, it turned out a big hoax by the military, trying to create a soldier female. It's always a female soldier hero. And, you know, we fell for it for a while, but that one blew up. And, you know, after it blows up, what happens? Nothing, because the media doesn't make anything of it. People are a little disgusted for a while, but then they forget about it. And that Iraq war went on for years, you know, and it didn't change people's opinion of the people who were running it. From our side. So this is why when we talked about it, I talked about in the beginning, these perceptions that get set in us, how we perceive things, it's very hard to change that once you get that set in people. Now, another thing about this Victoria Soto thing, that they've got these children from her classroom who survived. supposedly, but now investigators have decided not to formally interview the children based on advice from Yale child psychologists. Yeah, Yale, of course, we know is so in with the military-industrial establishment and so on. And now they use their psychologists to determine how these children should be treated. And they say that they say it's possible that some children escaped while Lanza was shooting others in the room. They're trying to account for all these things, but in the end, none of this has been accounted for properly. And they say also that state police are still trying to determine how many shots Lanza fired. This is what's taking them so long, I guess. They have to determine from the bullets around, from the magazines, from the this, from the that, just how many shots he fired. I don't know how important that is, but if it would help us to know whether he was capable of firing all those shots, they're probably going to come out and say that a whole lot of them were dropped on the floor and he didn't actually fire that many because he was too small and weak to be able to do all that kind of shooting so fast. Anyway, then they say that he killed himself in Soto's classroom with one of the two pistols he carried, and he killed himself as police entered the building. Of course, there's no photographs of his dead body, which there should be, and of the scene, of the guns sitting around him and so on. We don't see any of that, and we won't, unless they can do some good photo manipulation or make up some photos and make it look like this kid laying there. So I talked about that, and then I talked about the mothers. Now, I talked about that mother on Dr. Oz and all her makeup and how she was, you know, just sitting there looking like she was posing for the camera. But she was trying to help her son say the things right, too. But typical, these mothers, some of these mothers of today, some of these young mothers make you wonder why these kids are so screwed up. And then there's this Jewish mother, Jewish child, Noah Ponzer, who is also gotten quite a bit of attention. And he's I saw an interview of his mother just maybe it was on that website that I recommended to you last night. And she had this bright red lipstick on. I mean, it was so red. It was so dark. You know, these people, they get all made up for the camera, I guess. And then I don't want to say any more about her, but there's been a lot of questions about her. She didn't have any tears either. She's never had any tears. I saw a couple of interviews of parents just last night, and while they say all the right, they do a lot of smiling, but you can understand if their child is getting attention. You know, when somebody that you love dies, one of the things you think that hurts is that, gosh, the world is just going on. Nobody cares. You know, it's a big, big blow in your life and your family. And you can't imagine how the sun can be shining and how people can be going about their business and not caring. So when people come along and care and say something, you're really grateful, you know. And so I can understand that these parents might, for that reason, be willing to talk to the press and talk about their child, their daughter, their son, and say, you know, say all these nice things about them, because they want their children to be recognized. They don't want them to just be forgotten. And so that makes sense to me. But now this website I was trying to remember was globalresearch.canada.ca, which most of you would be familiar with, and that's where this academic James Tracy has been writing, and he is I was going to go through some of the stuff he wrote, but it's all pretty much been covered, and you can read him. He's got quite a few articles there, and then the radio interview he did was on Guns and Butter, and that woman's name is, what is her name? I sure don't see it here. I can't, you know, it's so, Faulkner, Bonnie Faulkner. Bonnie Faulkner on Guns and Butter. You can look for that. You can listen to the whole thing. You did a good job. So then I wanted to talk about references in movies and how I think so much of the stuff that goes on with movies is on purpose to confuse us, to confuse for people, particularly younger people, who are not all so young now because they've been watching these movies for a long time, but to confuse movies with reality. I think there's a real, that's part of the change in the perception of reality. That's a big part of it. And, you know, I quit going to movies quite some time ago, so I'm not familiar with these movies, but of course I read about it then when it comes up for some reason. And, there's a big thing made out of, the word Sandy Hook being on that map or map being where Sandy Hook is in the Batman movie. And that is quite inexplicable. It is. And I think that things like that, and how was it found out? Who was it that saw that? Or was that kind of leaked out, put out for people to say, oh yeah, that just to spread around that Sandy Hook was written on the map in the Batman movie. And then, there is, The Matrix. Remember the movie The Matrix that was one of the first really big movies about false reality, the red pill, blue pill. And I think that when people are confronted with an idea like this, and they then when something happens and it's being talked about, they think of the movie. And they even say, well, that's like in the movie. You know, this is just like in the movie. And this further confuses the world of the movie with the world of reality, in that you don't tell the difference, and that makes people more susceptible to, even than they already are, accepting what's in movies and it becoming more real than what's really happening. And this way that they use movies is kind of bad. It's really bad. And we should be aware of how they're doing this to us in the movies. So it's not just television that we have to boycott, but the movies. And this is really a lot to ask of people. I know that, but I don't see how we can keep from them changing our perception of reality as long as we keep being totally open to all this the ways that they do it through these imagery in television and movies, films, and obviously there's even be some YouTubes and so on everywhere. It's everywhere. Now, Countercurrents Publishing, I just want to mention, loves movies, and they like to write movie reviews, and they write a lot of movie reviews. And in fact, they posted several movie reviews about the Batman movie, and people were kind of asking, you know, what's this deal with Countercurrents in Batman? And Countercurrents is supposed to be such a sophisticated, intellectual, you know, bunch of intellectuals, why are they wanting to talk about Batman? Now, I didn't read those reviews. I may have started one, but I don't remember it. And, I don't know what was in them, but I don't think I've read some of their movie reviews, and I wasn't impressed with that they were giving us anything really sophisticated that we needed to know. It was just a plain old movie review. So they did that. But, you know, with this Sandy Hook, I checked there, and they have not said one word about Sandy Hook at Countercurrents. This is a month now, and they have not, that I can see, unless it's hidden somewhere, but that doesn't really count, they've not talked about Sandy Hook. I say they're afraid of it. They're afraid of it. But they will talk about the Batman movie and all these movies and encourage people to go see them. So I have to question that. And then another one hasn't talked about Sandy Hook is Kevin MacDonald and the Occidental Observer. I think with Kevin MacDonald, it's the same. He doesn't want to get in touch with it. He doesn't want to touch him. He doesn't know what position to take. I have a lot of respect for Kevin MacDonald. I want to make that clear. A lot of respect for him. I think that he has done very, very important work, and he has a right to distance himself from things that would hurt his credibility in the work he's done. I don't find any fault with that with him. I don't think he should throw himself away as a sacrificial lamb or anything, but I don't have the same opinion of Greg Johnson at Countercurrents. He certainly is not on the same level at all. And I'm suspicious that they don't write about Sandy Hook because they like to write about popular themes. Now, Kevin McDonald is just, it's too hot to handle for him. He doesn't know how to handle it and doesn't want to be associated with how it's being, you know, what's being said and so on. So that those are just two things I just wanted to mention for whatever. Now, people who have do go into it are the those who are known as the 9/11 truthers. And three that are well known are Kevin Barrett, who has the Truth Jihad radio program, and James Fetzer, and also Gordon Duff. Now, I call them the Three Stooges, Fetzer, Duff, and Barrett. But I used to have a lot of respect for Kevin Barrett, but once he joined up with these two so much and what he's been doing, I don't really anymore, although he comes across as a very reasonable person and a nice person. But I think there's another side of him that is because, you know, and these people are all left-wingers, including Duff. Duff is Jewish. And they're left-wingers, they're multiculturalists, and they're anti-nationalists and so on. So they come from a totally opposite side of the fence than I do. So therefore, you know, they wouldn't be my favorite people. But I also think that Fetzer and Duff are disinfo agents, or at least they put out disinfo on purpose. And I'm not sure about Kevin Barrett. It's kind of hard for me to come to that opinion about him. Because I still, you know, can't help thinking that he's a decent person, although his beliefs are wrong. But I think a lot of people think he is, and I think more and more that he probably is too. Although he may not think that of himself. He may think it's for other reasons that he doesn't. But or he may think he's right, you know, and not wrong. So it's misinformation as much as disinformation. But then there's this Jeff Prager, who I really was not familiar with, but he is also Jewish, and he's also an anarchist, and he's been big in the 9/11 movement. And now he was on Kevin Barrett's radio program just not too long ago, and I just managed to listen to it, I think, yesterday. And so I took notes and so on for today, and I just disagree with Prager, and I'm just going to stick with what Prager said in this program and why I think it's why it reveals that he is the promoting the official version of Adam Lanza as the sole gunman for the very reasons that they say, and nothing, he goes against nothing. Everything that we've seen about, everything that television is showing us is just the way, is what really happened, and he can prove it. He can tell us why, and he can explain every anomaly. You know, they're always talking about the anomalies in the Sandy Hook incident, and he can explain every one of them, he says. So he says that if anybody thought Sandy Hook was a false flag, it would be me. He said, I've been, because he's a 9/11 truther, you know, and he believes in all kinds of other things as being false flags. But suddenly not this. And he says, I've been all over it, very methodical. I used all the mainstream sources. Well, that's what this is kind of my synopsis from what he was saying. He's used all mainstream sources, all the ABC things, you know, NBC, blah, blah, CNN and New York Times, Washington Post, you know, Huffington Post, what have you. From the moment Lanza fired his last bullet, says Jeff Prager, and for the next 36 hours, all the truth was reported, okay? Everything that we need to know was reported in that time. And he's gone over that that amount. He's gone over all of that, and so therefore he knows all the truth because he studied everything that came out in the first 36 hours. And he says that he can separate what was wrong from what was truthful. And all the truth was there, and there were just some mistakes that he's, you know, weeded out to confuse that have confused people. And he says, Well, I already said that in different words. Okay, and then when they brought, Kevin Barrett starts bringing up the anomalies. He says, what about the map in the Batman movie? Kevin thinks that's really strange and unusual, can't be explained. And Prager says, there are other cities on that map, not just Sandy Hook, so it's just an accident. It's just an accident. That's how he explains it. That's, all his explanations are this way. This is why I think that he is a disinfo agent, or that he is playing a role here. He's doing the work of, he wants to keep it, you know, contained for whatever reason. So I don't trust this man. But so he says that, the map could have been put any other way, and that it was just put that way. So, Barrett brings up James Tracy and says, Tracy had brought up, how did the gunman fire so many shots in so short a time? Talking about, you know, the size of this guy and how weak he was. He weighed about 120 pounds, they say. I mean, that hasn't been contradicted. And Prager just says that the numbers are wrong. He said he didn't shoot that many. The kids didn't have that many bullets, or the teachers didn't have that many bullets in them. He said if you eliminate the average number of bullets, it wasn't the average number, is that the coroner said that one individual had 11 bullets, but that would have been probably the only individual that had that many, and others had far fewer, so that doesn't average out to that many bullets per person, which he could be right about that. And then he said that the gunman had 3 magazines totaling 90 bullets, He insists the time that he had to shoot was 10 to 15 minutes, whereas others have been saying 6 to 10 minutes, but he says 10 to 15 minutes. So he says that he could have done that. He says the children were huddled in corners with their teachers, so they were easy to kill, whereas that is not right. I mean, it's not confirmed where these children were when they were shot at all, and there's no confirmation from those who saw the crime scenes, the supposed crime scene, where the kids were laying and how it was done. Nobody will say anything. So these are all just stories that have come out from little kids. You know, little kids saying, oh, it was this or that, and they're all coached like that boy on Dr. Oz. But all these interviews with these little kids, their parents are there, and it appears that that they were asked to be interviewed, or they volunteered or something, and that they kind of worked out what was going to be said ahead of time. So, that's pretty clear if you just watch them all. Now then, Jim Fetzer calls in, and he accuses Prager. He doesn't go along with Prager. He accuses Prager of using police radio reports falsely and so on. And Prager says that and that there were these two people that were apprehended, and nobody will talk about them now. They're just thrown, you know, they're thrown away. These two men that supposedly were on the police radio reports. And Prager says, there's all this activity going on in the park around the school. So people are, anybody that they see, they're going to apprehend. Well, if there are all these people in the park at 9:30 and 9:45 and so on that were, involved in activities in the park. Well, they weren't apprehending them all. They were only going after two people that they was shown on some film, and some witnesses said that they saw the police, you know, walking one guy, putting him in the front seat of the police car, which this Ryan guy says is kind of unusual, rather than in the back seat. Like he was just part of the deal, and you know, things like that, but they weren't apprehended. So what Prager is saying here doesn't make any sense. And they don't talk about the drill. Some people have talked about a drill going on, and that these police reports sound like it would be a drill. Some of the early police reports sound like a drill, and that there were some policemen seen running past the school window before the shooting started. And what were they doing there? So, but you know, you can't corroborate these things. Kids say these things, and then if you try to corroborate it, the the journalists and the news media won't help you out, and they just forget it. You know, they don't print it, so you can't get anywhere with it, and you can't talk to these kids and these parents anymore. So the whole thing is closed off, cut off from any questioning. You know, Prager even said, if you're within a quarter mile around that school, you are going to be detained. Well, false. They weren't detaining everybody who was around that school. In fact, now the way this was set up was that some of you will know, you know, the fire station was down the road from the school, and that was the only road to the school. And there are indications, but I can't tell whether these, you know, if you can trust these videos, these video images, but there are indications that the only activity was around the fire station, and there was no activity around the school. But it would depend on when these video shots were taken. These are aerial shots of the area. If the aerial shots were not taken of the school during the time there was activity there, then you wouldn't see it, but I don't know. So, but if these things were proven to be at the time when they were supposed to be, like at the school when this was going on, and there was nothing there except parked cars, then you know something's really wrong. I mean, this has potential for being huge if you can get the evidence organized and sorted out right. But just like with that video maker that I talked about earlier, who was insisting that the two Parker girls were the same girl. You see, he's not helping matters any. I'm sure he's sincere, and he thought he had come up with something. But I think he's wrong, and he's going to be shown to be wrong, and that doesn't help. So we just this is what stops things. This is what I was talking about with 9/11. When you get too much information out there and conflicting, and people are insisting on what they've discovered or think they've discovered is correct, and they're arguing with one another, that's when it all goes to hell. And that's what they want, because they want us to do that. That they put these things out for that reason. I'm of the opinion that whatever happened may have been a total hoax or a partial hoax, but they have leaked out stuff, and they're going to continue to do so, to get people to come to the wrong conclusions in the beginning, and then be shown to be crackpots, you know, whatever. And this is what we have to watch out for. So I already talked about that. They talk a lot about these Facebook pages that were opened up before the event, that are about the event and fundraisers and so on, and rest in peace and so on. But again, it's disputed as to how they open these pages. They get a Facebook page, but they don't put anything on it for a while until something happens, or they get one and save it until they want to use it. All this could be true, so you can't go by that either. Then there was the nurse, Sally Cox, that a lot has been made out of. She actually gave false testimony about what she saw, and then later had to change it. And she said a lot of strange things, so you have to ask why and how credible a person is she, or how credible are a lot of these people in these schools. A lot of people in schools are not very smart, who work in grade schools especially. You know, they have to be kind of people who get along with little kids, and they're not the smartest people. I know that. And you can probably get them. They're very obedient types. You know, they're teachers. They're the teacher types, school types. They go along. They're not going to question things or rock the boat. So you can get them to say and agree to a lot of things, and they will actually think they're doing good and they're not lying or anything like that. They don't see themselves as doing anything false or fake. They don't question things. So, then there's a bit about the camo pants and so on. Well, I want to get back to, you know, this nurse even said that she knew Nancy Lanza. She told somebody somewhere that she knew Nancy Lanza. Oh, yeah. And she knew that this Adam was her son, and that Nancy Lanza was a kindergarten teacher at Sandy Hook. And absolutely false. And that was going around in the beginning. Now, are these things all, was this all done on purpose, or were these real mistakes? I tend to think that in the beginning there's some real mistakes, and that, but they do have planned. They do have things planned. They have to have things planned to, that are going to be false leads and so on and lead people off into the wrong directions and get all this discussion started. I don't want to belabor that point because I think that's known now. I just want to say that at one of the breaks, Kevin has several breaks on his show, commercial breaks, but then he plays music to come back to his program. And at the one of them, maybe not the last one, second to last one, I heard this song, The Reichstag Fire, the song that has a line in it about the Reichstag fire at the end. You know, there he is. He can't resist. He's talking about false flags, so he has to play that because he insists that the Reichstag fire was a false flag by the German government of Adolf Hitler to take over, you know, all the take over more power in Germany. He just insists on that because it fits his ideas so well. But it's absolutely false. I have to bring that up. All right. This is one thing why I don't like Kevin Barrett, because as many times he says he's open-minded and he wants to know the truth. But as many times as you explain to him, and this is, you can even go on Wikipedia and find out that most historians now do not go along with that idea that Hitler was behind, or Goebbels or Goering or any of them were behind the Reichstag fire. But there's a few of them. You know, the Jews and the hardcore communist types who do, and he won't let that go. So you can't reason with that man. Now, then things are said like things were said that coffins were closed and locked. Well, I don't think anybody ever said that, and you can't determine just because there are some funerals and people say they have funerals and. And there are even some open casket funerals. The only one I've ever heard of is the boy in his who was put in the baseball. He was such a baseball fan, just a little six-year-old boy, and they dressed him in his favorite baseball uniform that he liked so much, you know, for the open coffin, and people saw him. Now, maybe this is true, maybe it isn't, but I don't dispute it. I mean, I'm not in the in the mood at all to call all these people liars. But most of them were not open, but you can't determine, you can't tell people what to do at their funeral. The government, the strangest thing that I forgot to mention, but I did mention it last week, is that the coroner did not allow parents to see their kids until the undertaker had them. I don't think they were even allowed to come to the coroner's office to see them. And that is not right. And any real parents would be protesting against that. They just gave them a photograph of the child, of their dead child. They said the face only and didn't let them see him. Now, parents, I don't care how badly mutilated their child might be. Some parents want to see their child before they, you know, for one last time. And seeing him in a coffin is not the same thing. So I find hard to believe, you know, that parents would go along with that. No, there's a lot of these little things that you just can't explain properly. Now, let's see what's important here. What's really important is that then they started talking about gun control on this Kevin Barrett program. And in the gun control discussion, let me see, a caller was talking, and he said there's an overreaction to Obama's gun control measures he wants to pass. He said Obama gun control ideas are not so serious. They include mental health screening. What's wrong? They all agreed. Oh, nothing wrong with that. You know, and then they include criminal background checks. Well, nothing wrong with that. You know, why should criminals have, why should people who have any criminal? Of course, you know, you can have any little thing on your record and you're not going to be able to get a gun. And then Prager agrees that this is not a problem because every bill is watered down before it passes. So whatever is projected now will be watered down a great deal. So we shouldn't be so concerned about this gun control that they want to pass. And he also points out that there was gun control during Clinton administration, And then it was for a certain period of time, and they didn't renew it when it ran out. So, you know, it's all right. So they were just like, you know, minimizing the whole seriousness of the idea that Obama and all these liberals are going great guns. I mean, Biden's in charge of it now and everything in the Justice Department, in passing gun control legislation. They've got Dianne Feinstein, you know, working on it, as she always has been. And, they're like poo-pooing it. And this is why I don't like it. And even Kevin Barrett, oh, he did stand up against it. He did. Kevin Barrett argued with the rest of them that he didn't want gun control and why. But, you know, they're all liberals who love the government. And they are always going to think that the government, it's better to trust the government than to trust all these individuals who you don't know in society who are, you know, might be doing this or that wrong. So they said that Obama is considering closing loopholes and background checks, restricting high-capacity magazines, making gun trafficking a felony, prosecuting people who lie on their background checks, and ordering federal agencies to send data to a national gun database. Well, you see, they see nothing wrong with that except for Barrett. And they said, I don't see a way to stop. Prager says, I don't see a way to stop it. Bigger government. I care about the truth. He's talking about how critical the truth is to him. But he doesn't see a way to stop bigger government. He's already telling us that bigger government is coming, whether you like it or not. And he's an anarchist. Well, maybe that's how anarchists see things, and that's why they're anarchists. I don't know. But I think the guy is very strange because he was defending the police. And he said that anything that here it is. If a police officer tells me what guns were in the school, I'm going to believe that. No matter what ABC, NBC, CBS tell me. Now, this is very strange from an anarchist, wouldn't you say? I mean, in another place, he put a lot of faith in the police. He was going to believe whatever the police said. I'm running out of time here. This is where we need to look in our own ranks. Always, we need to look in our own ranks to who is saying what and who we can trust and who we can't. Because as it was said earlier, it's not only in the mainstream or the official versions of things, but it's in the alternative media also, where there's the intelligence teams that work on these things are infiltrated or are they're there too, and they're all over the place. And this is why it comes down, the best way to deal with this rather than fighting and arguing with people is to learn to see reality as it is. And if we have reached a level where we can do that, you can just look at this Sandy Hook thing almost from the start and realize that it's not right. There's something wrong. And the more you look at it, the more you know that it's not at all what they say, and you shouldn't trust or believe in any of it. What this teaches us is that in order to keep our wits and be able to see reality as it really is, we cannot be taking in the propaganda through the vehicles that they give it to us, which is mainly television and movies. Movies, I'm coming to see, are more important than I used to think they were, because I know how many people really go to these movies and just take them in like they just go right into their brain, you know, and they love these movies and they're very much affected by them. So the end thing that I want to leave you with, and I guess I'll be talking about more probably right on Monday a little bit, the same kind of a subject, maybe using a different way of talking about it, but that it's all about our perception of reality and the intelligence, the propaganda, the work that they're doing to demoralize and destroy us is to affect our perceptions so that we cannot see what we need. We cannot see things in a way that allows us to defend ourselves. We do not defend ourselves. We cooperate with them. And when we go to their movies and watch their TV and buy their great big big screen televisions, we are definitely cooperating with them, aren't we? So there's no way that that we can win or and survive unless we can disassociate from them enough to get our views straightened out and to see things as they really are. Those of us who understand 9/11, and there's a lot who understand 9/11. They might be very suspicious of Sandy Hook. They might understand Liberty Ship and lots of other things, but they still don't. They still can't understand the Holocaust. They still have to believe in the Holocaust. That's to me. That's the prime one. That's the number one. That's the toughest one of all. When you can overcome the Holocaust, you're really capable of seeing through most of it. And that's a kind of a sign, for me. And those who can't do that, I realize they're just, they have a lot of work to do, and I wouldn't trust them altogether. So, the message, ladies and gentlemen, is to realize that the attack is an attack on our perception of reality. It's on the very basis of what reality is. And this is what we have to understand in order to fight it and to defend ourselves. Well, I want to thank you all for being with me today. I enjoyed doing this program. It's right down my alley. And I think I had quite a lot of listeners, so I think you found it interesting too. And I thank you for being with me, and I will be continuing on these kinds of themes and on this subject in the future. So join me on Monday on the Heretics Hour. This has been Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager on the White Network, and this is Carolyn Yeager. Good day.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.